Thank you so much, gentlemen. I am excited to be here.
Well, good.
We are too. You came with 22-year-old whiskey.
This is Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon, bringing to you the best in news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen. And I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman. By now, you've probably heard about the legendary Stitzel Weller Distillery. And getting a taste of this whiskey that was created by this famous distillery is nearly impossible for the average person now. But there is one opportunity that remains where you can get just a hint at the greatness that once was. And Doug Craigle, he joins the show to give us the history and the in-depth breakdown of Blade & Bow. As a brand educator, he knows all about the products in the Diageo portfolio, and we try to dig into more about the identity of all these whiskeys. And to make everybody just a little bit more jealous of us, we even get to drink the very limited 22-year-old Blade & Bow release. With that, enjoy this week's episode, and now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Patreon member Jordan Ferguson, who writes me on fredminnick.com. Is there a science behind how much a whiskey gets marked up through the distribution and retail process? Well, Jordan, I'm no big city economic professor, but I have talked to many a distillers about this very, very issue. And the best person who ever kind of simplified it for me was the great Steve Thompson. Steve Thompson was the former president for Brown-Forman, and he's the founder of Kentucky Artisans Distillery in, you know, Crestwood, Kentucky. They have a brand called Whiskey Row and partnered with Jefferson's. He was an amazing man, a wealth of knowledge, and did not care about who he pissed off. I loved talking to him. But he basically said that the distiller on, and this is an average, this is going to vary from brand to brand, but on average, the distilling community will sell to the distributor at half of their SRP. So if a company says that their SRP is $100, they are actually selling it to the distributor for $50. So they're selling it to Southern and Glaciers, RNDC, River City, or whoever for $50. The distributor will then get it and then mark it up, you know, 25%. So in this case, it would be, they'll probably mark it up to 75. And so they will sell, the distributor will sell that SRP bottle of $100 to the retailer for $75. The retailer gets that bottle, it's $75. They can mark it up to the SRP. They can mark it up over. They can mark it up everywhere they want to, except under. It is actually against the law to market below wholesale cost in most U.S. markets. Now, it varies by state to state, but you know, alcohol being as regulated as it is, for the most part, a company cannot do that. However, there are some retailers who will mark below wholesale costs, and then they end up getting, you know, in trouble with the local ABCs. But by the time they end up paying all their lawyer fees, they've got the consumers. And so it's kind of like a weird marketing strategy slash, you know, legal inconvenience for some retailers. But that's kind of it. I mean, I don't know if there's really a science to it. It's just kind of the way that the industry works, and, you know, hindered by age old laws that you can't trust the distilling community because they will, you know, violate price fixing laws and so forth. I mean, you can read about that in my book, Bourbon, the Rise, Fall, and Rebirth of American Whiskey, where distillers try to run out like independent stores or independent bottlers and distillers by price fixing. And so there's all these laws on the books to protect the smaller guys and the consumers from the brands getting together and price fixing. But that's a great question, Jordan. And I think that there's not really much we can do to educate people on it, because everyone has a mentality that the store should sell for cheaper all the time because of Walmart, Amazon, but you just can't do that with alcohol. There's a lot of regulations attached to it. But that's going to do it for this week's Above the Char. If you want to be like Jordan Ferguson, hit me up on fredminnick.com and let me know your thoughts. Until next week, cheers.
It's that time again to get bourbon strong with Give270. Purchase your $50 tickets for your chance to win from our 50 bourbon prizes. Don't miss out on rare bottles and grand prizes like the legendary Pappy Set, a Weller Rainbow, and the Blood Oath Trilogy. Hurry, only 3,000 tickets are available. Single bottle winners go back in for the grand prize draw. Will you win the ultimate Pappy Set or one of our other incredible prizes? Get your tickets now at Give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 000273.
It's that time of the year where everybody's starting to make their vacation plans on visiting Kentucky, the mecca of bourbon. And if you are coming to Kentucky, you need to make sure you visit us at Pursuit Spirits in Louisville. We're right in the heart of Clifton, near Butchertown and Nulu, and only just a few miles away from downtown Louisville. But when you do come, you need to book your experience to go do our whole shebang. This is the one that's really the star of the show. You get a full-on tasting. You get to do your own personal barrel selection experience. And you get to grab a whiskey thief and fill your bottle directly from the barrel. We're doing something completely brand new that nobody else is doing here in bourbon country. Plus, you get a free sweet tasting glass at the end of it. I guarantee you, you're going to end up being one of the many people that's also leaving us a 5-star review. So make sure you come and check us out. You can book your reservation by going to pursuitspirits.com and clicking the Visit Us button. From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com. Welcome back. Another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny and Ryan here today talking about a brand that I think everybody knows. Literally everybody in bourbon knows about the brand, but we've never done a deep dive on it and really to understand more about it, its history. You know, it's kind of the lineage of the Stitzel-Weller kind of family as well when Diageo kind of took it over. So it's going to be kind of interesting to pull a little of these behind the curtain of it.
Yeah, I got a lot of questions lined up. No.
like, how hard can we snuff them today?
No, I remember when this first came out, it was kind of in line with, you know, we're talking about Blade and Bow today, but it's kind of in line with all the Orphan Barrels. You know, Diageo released those, and then this kind of soon followed after. Beautiful packaging, you know, it came out with 22 years age span, and then I think there was like a 15-year at one time, or maybe not. I don't know. I'm whiffing. But
we'll get into that
yeah,
for sure.
I had the 22-year-old, but it's been a long time. It's when it first came out. But, man, I always was a big fan of those Orphan Barrels. Like, sometimes people gave it a hard time because they're like, oh, it's packaged, you know, in Tennessee and this and that. And there was kind of like a mystery around it. But I was a huge fan of those.
It did catch some slack early on from, oddly enough, like folks like us that are very heavy into bourbon and enthusiasts aside to kind of figure out, like, wait, how are they really orphan if they just found them? And like, where are the originations? Like, why is it proof solo? But there's something to say about the packaging and how well it's done from a brand perspective, because it's not like you see them sitting on shelves. Like, they're selling out, right? So there is something to say about how well it does do in the market.
Yeah, and everybody collected the whole, you know.
Oh, the whole set.
The whole set.
Remember when they came out that huge, like, 6-bottle set that came in, like, the wooden case? Oh, yeah, see?
I know, and I had 3 of them, and I was like, well, do I want all of them again? It's like, it was a good chunk of change, but now looking back, I should have done it.
I just remember Lost Prophet being one of my favorites.
I liked Barter House, and I loved the one, Blowhard with the whale. It was like a 26-year-old. And I was like, and usually 20 that old tastes like straight wood. It was like perfectly balanced. It was really good.
Well, let's go ahead and introduce our guests.
We're rambling.
We'll get back to Blade and Bow. We're not going to hop on the Orphan Barrel stuff today. But today on the show, we have Doug Kregel. He is an educator of Blade and Bow, as well as part of the Diageo Accelerator portfolio. So, Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. I am excited to be here.
Well, good.
We are talking whiskey. You came with 22-year-old whiskey.
Well, that's the way I make friends, as much as I can, right? Like, if I come with whiskey, I feel like people are going to listen to me talk for at least 20 minutes.
We can get you 20
minutes. We'll give you 45.
Deal. I brought 2 whiskeys, so yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly.
There you go. We'll split it between the half there. Before we talk about the brand, kind of
talk about you a little bit. So sure. How did you come into this role? How did you get into whiskey, and how did you figure, you know, this is a fun thing? Because we actually talked about before we started here, you go by educator versus a lot of people in the space go by brand ambassador. So kind of talk about how you got into this particular role.
Sure. Yeah. So it's one of those things. I feel like there's no clear trajectory when it comes to brand ambassadors and like education within, I think, any spirit category in general. But for me, it was particularly like I was in the hospitality industry, right? Managing, working in bars, restaurants, all of that kind of stuff, until a point when I eventually had to decide to like get, you know, graduated college. It's like, all right, now you got to get the like adult job, and went into sales first. Realized really early on that I was a pretty terrible salesman. You know? You know, one of those things like sales rep, yeah. Working.
You're just like giving it away. But, just, well, you know, it's not really working here.
It was one of those things where it's like, you know, it's hard to force someone to something they don't need. Like for me, it was this idea that I was only good. I realized really quickly, I was only good at selling certain things and to certain people. And it was about like fitting it into the right space. And that's when I had the opportunity. They were hiring the first, it was actually George Dickel was the brand at the time, the first national ambassador for George Dickel Tennessee Whiskey. And a mentor of mine had actually mentioned, he's like, listen, you really should go for this. I mean, this is where your world, like this is where you fit in. And so that started my journey. That was 10 years ago. This coming July.
What space was your mentor in? Was he in the spirits industry?
Yeah, yeah. A gentleman by the name of Ewan Morgan.
Oh, we've had you on the show.
I'm sure you have.
Golly, that had to have been in the...
Eons ago. It
was previously the episode, probably 40, if I had to guess, when we had Ewan on. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. So he, I mean, this was in the days of like they had the Master Whiskey program focused on Scotch whiskey. This was like a subset. The first time that an iconic whiskey ambassador program was venturing into the American whiskey space, right? 10 years ago. So that, which I think lines up with the timeline of what we've seen for trends anyway. So he was the one who kind of recommended that I go on this journey. And then from there, it was all about, I've always worked with Diageo brands, and it was like the resources that they've allowed me to have, you know, everything from, of course, doing like the executive bourbon steward here in Louisville to actually taking like the GCD over from Scotland. So taking that general certificate of distillers and like malt advocate courses. So I've been able to like slowly add more and more education into like my skill set, which has been fantastic.
What was Dickel like when you started? Like, what were they at? And like, what were their, you know, because we know where they are now, but back then, not a lot of people probably knew about them. Like, what were their goals at the time? Like,
you
with
know,
Dickel?
It was, this was pre even like the Dickel Rye launch, right? So when I came into it, what was really fascinating was it was actually, they still had the Cascade Hollow recipe, which was like a 3-year-old red label that was on the shelf. And it was Dickel 8, Dickel 12, and that was about it. And so they were just looking at a way to really expand into the on-premise more than anything else. Like that was the goal. That was, I think, everybody's goal at that point was like, all right, we need to focus so much more on bars than we do on retail.
And that seems to be what Diageo is really good at.
Yeah.
We just read a study. Bullet was like the photo of the best spirit, you know, bartenders use or whatever.
Yeah, it's a focus, right? Like it's definitely from Diageo. It's one of those focuses of being like food occasion and the on-premise has been something that's, you know, been a really big focus. But that was like the turning point right around that time period. And so it was still a small brand, but it was a small family of marks at that point. And now they've kind of expanded a lot more. So it's been pretty interesting to see the growth of that whiskey.
And how long were you doing the Dickel portfolio before you started moving on to other things?
So that was until 2015, essentially, with the launch of Blade & Bow. And as well as actually the year previous, they had just relaunched Ida B. Harper into the market as well. So those two whiskeys really like expanded my reach.
I think that's where I was confused. The 15 years. Ida B. Harper, because they came out at the same time.
I always forget Ida B. Harper is a part of the portfolio too sometimes though.
Yeah, yeah. It was that expansion of American whiskeys. And then from there, I like slowly would just continue to collect whiskeys until it's pared down for like the current version of my job. But it was Harper, then it was Blade & Bow. I've been a part of that brand since it was launched, which is, it's really fascinating to be a part of something from inception and watch it grow when it comes to like the American whiskey space. And then even, you know, got to work on Bulleit for a while, as well as even up to like Crown Royal, expanded to North American whiskey for a couple years before kind of a reshuffle of where those brands sat within Diageo. And then they focused it back in to just Dickel and Blade & Bow, two brands that like are the accelerator idea is this idea of just like trying to promote growth within a certain set of markets, as opposed to like a just a blanket kind of marketing plan across the country. So it's really about focusing in and then allowing like natural growth.
Gotcha. That was going to be my next question, was talking about how does the accelerator program really work, and how do you determine those markets? Is it just general populace? Is it because these are the bars that we want to hit for on premise? Like what's that criteria?
I think it's a brand to brand kind of set. Blade & Bow is all about very, like, that brand has grown so slowly, and it went from basically what we called as like an incubator model, where it was like year one, it only launched in four markets. It's the four corners of the whiskey world, as I like to consider it, right? It was Louisville, Chicago, New York, and San Francisco, right? It was like hit all the big ones, that was it. And then round two of their launches was basically your next level whiskey towns, you know, and that was everything from, let's say, Seattle, Denver, places like that for sure, Portland. And then from there, they started to tap into their consumer, which was like the Southern culture and lifestyle. So then it kind of hooked the Southeast, everywhere really from DC down the coast, across over to New Orleans. It was like that backwards J hook, I guess, of the Southeast is what they ended up kind of focusing in on, which is still today, I think, the core for how they're like really marketing the brands. There's continual growth and expansion within the next year or so, but it's about being available to everyone in select places instead of being unavailable to everyone everywhere, you know, is kind of the focus.
With that many cities, are you wrapping Delta Diamond by that point of going through everybody?
It's because I am a Delta guy, and I'm on every three-year track before this past year, of course. Absolutely. You know, I was on an every 3 year cycle for hitting Diamond.
Wow. That's a lot of flights.
Yeah. But 2020 was supposed to be my Diamond year, and it got knocked off right at the end. Unfortunately, it was like the last couple, you know, with that March or whatever it was, where the last couple trips got knocked off, and I was like, man, I was almost there. So I had to start the whole cycle over again.
Oh, well, yeah. Now you're just, what, platinum? That's mm-hmm. That's unfortunate. You're still, at the rate with what we're seeing with air travel, you're still getting bumped up no matter what.
That's true.
So you're getting that. All right, so let's talk about a little bit more about the brand and Blade & Bow a little, because this is kind of like your baby that you've been around. How long you've been doing with the brand now? For 5 years? Is that how long?
Yeah, so 6 years, really. I mean, now we're at 2015 to just now into 2022. So we're looking at six and change. Really,
what was the genesis of Blade & Bow? Like, why was it created? What you kind of described a little bit a second ago, who you're trying to target or whatnot, but talk about that, the genesis of the brand.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating because, you know, so many times whiskeys are focused around lineage from like a name's perspective, and that's usually a person's name, right? For a lot of it, at least historically, that's what we see. And this whiskey was created around a place instead of a person, you know? And so as you kind of imagine what that's going to manifest to be, Blade & Bow is a whiskey that is pulling from stories and references from the Stitzelweller distillery. And so since Diageo, we owned the facility, and it's been a part of our library, if you want to call it, or the campus has for quite a while now, but they had this moment where they realized they had in their possession some of that last remaining bourbon that was distilled in the on property right in that 1991, 1992 time period.
Now that's an orphan barrel to find right there.
Well, see, and that's the thing, right? So Orphan Barrel already was operating really nicely, and it was a successful kind of portfolio as it was, but I think there was a choice to be made, and it was, do we take this whiskey and put it into an Orphan Barrel and have a one-off, you know, Stitzelweller liquid and just use that as it is, pull those barrels and that's it? Or what they landed on was finding an opportunity to start to build and create something built on the stories of the past that can start to move into what the future of the facility can be. And that's what they landed on. They had to find a unique way to take some of that old bourbon and yet still create something that was going to be viable from a multiple market perspective, you know, instead of just being able to say, all right, here's a one-off release, it's going to go to collectors and then we're pretty much done with it. And that's where they landed on what I consider to be like traditional innovation within bourbon, you know, and that was using the Solera method to stretch out and elongate that old whiskey in order to create something that could constantly kind of move forward and have that kind of multi-tiered mingling process.
Before we get into that sort of mingling process there, when you think about the brand, you couldn't call it anything that said Stitzel Weller on it, because a lot of that's sort of trademarked and passed between a lot of different places and it was unable. But how did the name Blade and Bow come about?
Right. That's a great question, right? So it still comes back to the stories. And yes, you know, I mean, it's like, I feel like every day that I talk about this whiskey, I have this like distinct privilege of being able to talk about and be a steward for historical stories that aren't ours. We don't own them in any right, but we have to find a way to give them the respect they deserve, because obviously, you know, you talk about Stitzel Weller and it's like a cornerstone of like this industry and what it's grown up to be.
I think that's probably one of the good things that we should probably reiterate to a lot of our listeners that might be new to this world, is that Stitzel Weller is by far is one of the powerhouses of American whiskey back in the day. And to this day, if you can get your hands on old bottles of Stitzel Weller, most people say it's some of the best whiskey that you've ever tasted. Unfortunately, it was just, you know, like everything else, just suffered from a glut era.
Wrong place, right time.
Yeah.
Wrong time.
Yeah,
exactly.
They could just survive 10 more years. It would have been.
It might have been okay. Might have been okay. And that's one of the things that people need to understand, is that's what made Van Winkle famous, was Stitzel Weller stock. It's not because of the name. It's not because whatever. It's because of that particular whiskey that made them famous. Anyway, back to your story.
So it would 100% agree, right? Like, and we can go into all that history too. And it's so fascinating. And like, I feel lucky that I get to go to that facility as many times as I do and walk around and just feel it and soak it in. And it's soaking all of that in that really—
The ghost of Weller past kind of hanging out.
Exactly. So it's soaking all that in that really gives you the opportunity to like see how it's manifest in the bottle. So back to the name. So Blade and Bow is the anatomy of a skeleton key. So like, just like the key that's on this bottle here, this is the blade is going to be the shaft of the key. And then the bow is going to be the ornate handle. So the name itself, even though it feels like a hunting reference almost, right? You know,
hunting / farming, something like that. Right. Who knows? Yeah,
it is. Just like our logo itself, which is those five keys, it's referential to that story, the five keys, right? And it's, I think when you look at a lot of stuff coming out of Stitzel or anything that is connected to like the last remaining, you have like a lot of key imagery. And it's because of that idea that when they opened Derby Day 1935, there were five keys that hung on the front door. And they were that symbol of the five steps of making great whiskey. So it was that grains, yeast, fermentation, distillation and maturation. But what I always find to be the cooler part of the legend of that is that they were the actual keys to the building. And so it was a symbol.
It's like it's not hidden underneath the rock up front. You don't have to lift that or underneath the doormat. It's literally just hanging on the door if you want to.
It's like, it's right here. I just love that from a symbolic perspective. It's like, I think it represents hospitality in the bourbon industry, like that kind of gesture. It's like before bourbon tourism, before all of that, before there was a bourbon trail for people to be trying to come and visit. If you had business there and you saw the keys on the front door, then you already knew that you could get through the barrier, that it was open, welcome for you. So it was this idea of like you had that feeling approaching the building. And so that's one of the stories that I think inspired such a beautiful package as well.
Yeah, isn't there on like, I know the Larceny brand and Old Fitz brand stem from the Stitzel and Larceny as the key holder mm-hmm. or something too. So it's like, it's all making sense now.
Yeah, it's such a, and people may not draw that kind of conclusion, but it's such an important piece of imagery and such a really fascinating story that's within like the roots of that distillery. And I think it just, you know, has inspired so many brands and so many things.
So the other obvious question that I'm going to get to here is those Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Mm-hmm. So where, I'm not going to ask like, where did you get it from? But how does the partnership
work? Where'd
you
get it from?
Where'd you get it from? But I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, I know Diageo is a huge company. And so is it one of those things that like these partnerships were made and formed a long time ago? Was it saying, hey, we're starting to do this thing, we got to go buy some stuff in the open market? Do you know like the sort of origin behind where the whiskey is a part of this?
Yeah. So, I mean, the core is still coming from that pre-1992 shutdown bourbon, right? And so that, from my understanding, of course, you know, we only have so many answers because contracts and all the things, yep. But
we're very well aware,
right? But it's, I think it's the core is that pre-1992. And I always make the assumption is that those are the kind of things that come with the sales of facilities like that, you know, within the stocks of the warehouses, as opposed to open market purchase stuff. But Diageo and our, you know, Blade & Bow, I think we have the connections and the contracts within like the bourbon industry to be able to then figure out who we can source from in order to craft the second part of creating this whiskey, which is blending this, like that fractional blending system. So like we have criteria, but then I think from there, it's really a matter of what we're already getting and what kind of supply is out there.
So you call it fractional blending. The other mm-hmm. word people call is Solera. Is that kind of what you're going
yeah.
towards?
Yeah. So Solera, like the great thing is, so Solera is historically, right, from the sherry industry. It's hundreds of years old. Bodegas in the Sherry Triangle have been using the Solera system for the fortified wines, you know, and we are using a fraction of the kind of process of that and applying it to bourbon. We're not trying to promote the growth of wild yeast on the bourbon like they do, like that kind of stuff, but we are trying to use that fractional blending portion of it. So that's why I usually reference it that way. And it also,
can you explain Solera just for someone who might not understand that?
100%. So
for you?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm just kidding.
I'm trying to hide my discrepancy, my inefficiencies here.
Well, so it, imagine a like a pyramid of barrels sitting on like a warehouse floor, right? Where you're going to have, for us, it's five levels. Traditionally in Solera, it was like a three level process, but we're using five. And so if you imagine that pyramid of barrels, level five is going to have that oldest bourbon in it, right? So that's going to be that pre-1992 shutdown bourbon. And then if you jump all the way to the top one is where we enter in what would be considered in the sherry, like new wines. But for us, it's going to be no younger than 6-year-old Kentucky straights going into the level one. And then every time we pull from the bottom level, if say we take 100 gallons out of level five, level four, we'll take 100 gallons out of level four, fill five. And then from three to four, two to three, one to two. And then we're taking 100 gallons of, you know, no younger than 6-year-old Kentucky straight bourbon, and that's going into level one. And that process will repeat over again. So not only is it age by age, starting six, and then level two, seven, level three is eight, because as you can imagine, we're not fully draining the barrels. That would defeat the purpose of preserving all this anyway. So it's compounding on itself every single time you blend downward. I usually describe it too as like either a champagne or a chocolate fountain, depending on what you prefer. But you know that idea, when you're pouring in the top, that top glass will fill the next one, will fill the next one, will fill the next one. So it ends up being, in 2015, we had to essentially manufacture something that's been happening for hundreds of years with the sherry industry, which is having multiple ranges of ages within each level. So when we started, it was no younger than, at the time, it was no younger than, there was 7-year-old is what we started off for level one, 7-8 for level two, 7-8-9, 7-8-9-10, 7-8-9-10-21. Which is what we clocked that pre-1992 at when we started the system. And then every year it compounds over and over again. Plus they're sitting in cooperage as well. So, I mean, you still have aging there, even though it is non-age statement, because this process is definitely, you know, throwing out the window the idea of what our age requirements are. And 6-year-old would just not, I don't think, do justice to the flavor profile of what we're tasting in the whiskey.
Yeah, it tastes a lot older.
It does.
Really balanced. It's like a quintessential Kentucky bourbon, like all those good notes.
Yeah. Well, and the thing I love about this system, and I consider it to be, like I said earlier, I consider it to be like a traditional innovation. You know, whiskey innovation can make people think of all sorts of things these days, right? But the same way that I consider like the concept of barrel finishing to be, it's a, such a historic process, but it is innovation. You know, it was innovative when Angel's Envy did it. You know what I mean? It's innovation in a way that is drawing on history to create something new in this, in the bourbon space. And so this process for us, I think, gives us the opportunity where, like, this whiskey to me smells like an older whiskey, or smells like a younger whiskey and drinks like an older whiskey. So, like, my favorite part about a 5-year-old bourbon is the nose. But my favorite part about drinking a 20-year-old bourbon is how complex the palate is, you know? And, like, this kind of gets you both because of all of that kind of blending.
So if you talk about fractions, I'm sure not the first time somebody's asked this. So what's the fractional percentage of Stutzweller that's in that bottle right there?
That's where the PR person kicks in.
I'm gonna pause for a second.
There you go. Yeah, pause on that.
She takes off mute.
No, I mean, but I mean, that's, it's funny to kind of say that, because I'm sure that's a question that you typically get, and it's impossible to really know. And it's kind of interesting the fact that most people, when we talk to them about their particular bourbon, they're like, "Oh, how many barrels go into your small batch product?" And they're like, "Well, you know, it's 10, it's 1,000. Doesn't really matter what that's going to be, but yours is not going to be like that. It's going to be something that they're just continually dumping into. Either is it dumping into tanks and then draining or agitating? Like,
So it's like, I kind of try to describe it as I can imagine. It's like a super complicated version of Leapfrog for bourbon. You know, it's the idea, like, you know, you get those neutral vats that we're going to dump into, right? And so we'll dump level 5 into a vat and then level 4. And then as we pull off, and then pull off from 4 to put into 5 in that full dump, and then they're going to refill 5. Then we'll dump 3, you know, put it into a vat. And so it's like this constant, like, with space and everything else, it's such a complicated process. You can't dump everything at once. You've just got to keep it in check, and you've got to, like, consistently keep jumping over each other to put it all together, which is one of the reasons it's, you know, it's a really complex process. And I think that is probably definitely informed why it's not a full launch, right? Why it's so much harder to say that it's available everywhere, and why we wanted to focus in on specific markets, because it's a labor intensive process to just to pull, you know, what would be traditionally, all right, pull these lots, dump them, quality check, bottle, hit the road. And, you know, it's a little bit, there's so much more and a lot more labor that goes into it.
So do you have a team that works on this, or is there one, like, master blender that's like, in, like, that's your baby, or?
Well, so we definitely have teams. You know, the great thing is, I think the North American team for Diageo in general, like, when it comes to, like, the blending teams, they are, you know, constantly collaborating with each other, you know, and working together. So it's, you know, it's all the staff out at Stutzweller, which is where all the process is happening, from, like, the actual labor and pulling the barrels and dumping. And then, like, the first quality check's going to happen there. Then we also have sensory labs in Shelbyville with the new labs that were opened out there with the Bullet Distilling Company, as well as a sensory lab down in Cascade Hollow, plus where, like, our bottling facilities are in Plainfield and things like that. So they're all over the place. It's like constant check, double check, triple check kind of situation.
So it is a big team effort.
Big team effort.
Big team effort.
Big team effort.
So I'll ask a tough question. So what would you say to people out there that are sort of like naysayers of it? And they're like, and they say there's a bunch of 20-year-old Stutzel in it. I don't believe it. How do you field questions like that? And how do you sort of, like, put that more to ease to say, like, no, like, other than me sitting you showing you pictures of the barrels being dumped in there, like, how do you answer something like that? Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/bourbon. So what would you say to people out there that are sort of like naysayers of it? And they're like, they say there's a bunch of 20-year-old Stitzel and I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Like, how do you field questions like that? And how do you sort of like put that more to ease to say like, no, like, other than me sitting you showing you pictures of the barrels being dumped in there, like, how do you answer something like that?
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, I totally understand the position, you know, and I know for a fact too, when you think about it, this is a romantic, it's going to become a romantic notion at some point. If we're stretching it out and we continue to grow and we continue to sell, it's going to become this idea that it's going to get less and less and less.
Yeah, basically you should have bought the first release of Blade and Bow.
Right.
But the great thing is, think about it. So
I like this release. This one's really good.
That's what, I mean, it's one of, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it's one of those things, you're right. It's on the nose, it's a little bit younger, but on the taste, you get the oak and a little bit more depth.
It's got such a rich mouthfeel. Yeah. It's good.
It's complexity. And I mean, when we think about in 2015, the ages that we were using for this process, well, we still have the next one under the 21-year-old that was that pre-1992, that was 10 years old, right? And now we're 6 years later. So now we're, I mean, that's evolved to 16-year-old bourbon as it is. So it's one of these things that it is an idea that's building on the past to create something for the future. And like we can't always hold on to it forever, but it's such a part of our identity, you know? So what I would say is it comes down to the way it drinks, you know, and like,
tastes good. What's it matter?
Right. and like just building off of the process. I mean, maybe it was that old pre-1992 shutdown bourbon that got you to buy the first bottle, but hopefully it's that, you know, that last glass out of the bottle that's getting you to buy the next one, you know, kind of situation.
Is it funny? Sometimes you're like, well, the reason that there's that 22-year-old bourbon is because it didn't sell back then. You know, we're improving it through our process, you know?
Yeah. You know, well, I definitely think that...
you could use that one. Use that in your next education session.
If they had given me an opportunity to taste it before it went in there, I'm sure it was also absolutely delicious. Oh, wow. I mean, how could it not be? I did get a chance to try. We did have I believe it was a 24-year-old Stitzelweller that was an auction item that was, I think, in 2016 that we released. That was a single barrel. It went through Christie's. I think it was like one of the highest at the time, but, right?
Like 2016, a full barrel?
Full barrel.
Oh, geez. We should have known about it.
It was, I think it yielded 34 or 38 bottles total.
Oh, wow. Oh, gosh.
Right? From the barrel because it was at 24 years old, but it was fascinating. And that was, I tried that. And I mean, that was delicious, you know, even at that age range, which, you know, like you said in the beginning, sometimes you assume over 20, you know, it's a crapshoot.
Right.
Dicey.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is kind of cool to kind of know more about the brand from that perspective. And like I said, I always have to take this sort of devil's advocate approach to it because people are going to want to know. Mm-hmm. And I guess that kind of leads to the next question.
Because the bourbon communities, they're so nice.
You know? They are. There's nobody's like happy-go-lucky all the time with it. So when we talk about like this idea of stretching out and stretching it out, we know that that particular stock isn't going to be there forever. Does that mean that Blade and Bow, in essence, is something that a brand may not be able to last forever because all those older barrels are just not going to be there? Or is it the idea that cellar aging, there's going to be half of a fractional percentage that's going to be in every single bottle?
Yeah.
Until whenever.
So, and that'll happen at some point, right? Like that's going to have to be something that happens. But at that point too, we're hopefully looking at these opportunities to, one, in 2015, along with launching Blade and Bow, we also launched the Stillhouse B project, which is, you know, something where we've been laying down barrels, like the first new liquid to be produced on site was at that same launch time, you know. And so we have been distilling bourbon on site at Stitzelweller that we're putting down in warehouses. So most of that is this idea of research and development. You know, it's definitely a small craft still. It's about a barrel a week is, I think, what our production on the four day run, right? Yeah. It's a tiny guy versus, you know, compared to the column still that used to be at Stitzelweller, which was 65 feet tall. And I think it made like a barrel every 4 minutes and 16 seconds or something like that. But we're still trying to create the environment to hopefully propel us into the future. And like laying down these barrels is never a bad idea. And like, hopefully, you know, I would love personally to see it come full circle in that way, that we could be incorporating some of the, there is still some of the last remaining bourbon distilled there, and we could incorporate some of the newest bourbon that was distilled there, you know. But I'm a romantic when it comes to whiskey.
Okay. Let's keep the romantic dream alive here. Cause that does bring up another question when I think about it too, is, you know, Diageo owning the old Stutzwalder facility. What's the idea of just having the small still and not trying to recreate the magic that was once there?
I think you said it in part of it. You know, I mean, I think it would be amazing to be able to do, but the facilities as they are, you know, I mean, you were there, you've seen it. It's a big endeavor.
Yeah.
And I think that right now we're focused on the hospitality side of Stutzwalder more than anything else. And that's where the investments have been so far. So I think that the craft still was a great start. I think that I would love to see it happen, but I think it's a big project to be able to, that still isn't even in there anymore, right? There's a section of it, one third of it sitting on the tour path. The rest of it, I think, was either scrapped or they, you know, sent it back to Vendome to see what they could do with it. The doubler itself, that thumper went to...
It's a bullet now.
Yeah, it's at BDC, which is pretty cool. And it looks just like, you know, just like it should. I mean, like recreated, still has the brick on the bottom of it, like just kind of like the beer well does out there at Stutzel, like that kind of construction, which is pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I guess if your boss's boss ever listens to this and we look at the trajectory of where things are going, and I don't know, I think it would be a decent investment to say, hey, let's try and recreate the magic that every whiskey geek loves here. Granted, it's never going to be the same, but you at least have the components. You'd have to talk to the people at Bullet, be like, oh, I'm sorry, we're gonna need that Devler back.
Yeah. Yeah, you know that thing we gave you?
We need that back over here.
That might be a hard sell right there.
Yeah. You know, just take down a wall here and there and, you know, move. But no, I digress on that one. No, I think it's kind of cool to see the history and kind of how that's all coming about. I do know that we had a chance to actually meet at the Garden and Gun Club, which is now happening at the distillery. Kind of talk about that too.
Yeah, so it's amazing. I mean, I know you guys have probably seen this. The thing I love the most about it, besides the design and our partnership, but I do think that just having cocktail bars and food at Kentucky distilleries, like the first time I walked in there, I feel like
it's a win-win.
It changes the feeling when you walk into a facility where you're like, all of a sudden you're like, wow, people are just, you can just hang out. You know, we're not like kind of like in, but then you feel like, oh, I can't like linger. They got more tours coming through. But now you can like meet a friend for a drink, you know, and just like hang and be like, wow, we're talking about whatever it is that we want to talk about over a great cocktail in like this historic facility. And that's the evolution that I think was where the partnership comes from. Like the idea that Garden and Gun magazine is been a partner with Blade & Bow since the beginning, since 2015. And it's primarily been events across the country, as well as like just everything from, they helped design and get us created the Blade & Bow horse trailer that was traveling the country to major events and whiskey festivals and things like that. And then we get to this point of, finding what's the next step. So them leasing or licensing us the opportunity to use the same name that is the Garden and Gun Club in Atlanta, which is this amazing facility right outside of the new Braves ballpark in that promenade area. And it's just like a wonderful cocktail bar that just is all brass and perfect, you know, mid-century modern. And a little piece of that is now on the second floor of the Stutzwalder Distillery, which was historically offices and storage and everything else, on the second floor of the administrative office, the original one. So it just fits perfectly.
I've been there. They're good cocktails.
Yeah,
I still need to go. You need to take me, Kenny.
We'll get there sometime. I'll take you on a date sometime soon.
So where at today is Blade & Bow? Like, where, you know, you said you started with the Four Corners and this and that. Where are we at with the brand and where are we going in the future?
Well, I think we're in the middle of like another expansion when it comes to markets that it's launching into. But I think we're up to, last check for me was around 18 plus markets, right? And like that's changing this year. So I think that will continue, but it is kind of the core whiskey markets, and then a primary focus within the Southeast. And I think that is, you know, there's a direct correlation between things like magazine readership as well when it comes to like Garden and Gun. It's the, because the feeling, that's part of the evolution of that brand, or those two brands together, is they just feel like very similar kind of brands as well. And so it's kind of focusing on that kind of sporting leisure and lifestyle that goes along so well with whiskey, as well as, I think, tweed jackets and hunting dogs, you know?
Seersucker.
You know, I need some elbow patches on my jacket or something. Like
yeah.
That too.
Yeah, yeah.
I did have one question too, because we had mentioned earlier that on these Blade & Bow bottles, there's a key on the side of it. Mm. If, correct me if I'm wrong, aren't they numbered or something like that?
Yeah, so it's a direct correlation to that story of the five keys. So there are five different keys on every bottle. This one here is a one key. You can tell, one, because there's a number one on it, but well, two.
Start our
right?
collection.
Here we go.
But it also, so you number a skeleton key by the voids that are on the key, right? So there's one negative space. There's actually two teeth, and that'll continue all the way up to five. So all five keys, collect all five, and you get inducted into the Five Keys Club at Stutzweller. So we have about 1,800 members right now, and it's been running for a few years now. But
that's way cooler than the shot ski.
So what's the club member get you?
So you get your name engraved on a gold julep cup, and it sits on the shelf at Stutzel. And like that's I already cool. said, I'm a romantic about this kind of stuff, right? So to me, the coolest part is just, wait, my name is up on the wall at Stutzweller.
You get to get a cocktail made in it?
If you want to, right?
That would be cool. So, hold off the wall. Like, hold off the wall.
I want an old fashioned in my cup, you know?
There you it's go. Like, we do make a mean julep out there at the Garden and Gun Club as well. But yeah, so it's one of these things where you can come through, you know, find your cup. If you wanted to, you could talk to us and you could probably take it with you. But I personally would leave it there so that you, so your name's there. Or get a cocktail with it if you want. We'll wash it out first.
That's awful nice of you. So, Ryan, before we start, if you've never nosed the 22, you need to nose the 22
Man,
before
been,
you get to it.
I've been digging the standard Blade & Bow. It's really good. I mean, yeah. What's hell, my glass is almost gone.
What's the proof on the standard?
90.
90. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I, okay. 90,
I'm sorry, 91.
91. 91. And a little bit, just a little bit above.
Just, yeah, 0.5.
But before we get into this 22 year right here, because I've had this before and it's phenomenal. The nose, I could just sit there and nose for days.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Kind of talk about bringing in a more limited edition release into the portfolio, the thought behind that versus creating some sort of like one-off, another orphan barrel or something like that.
Before that, I just smelled this and you know that argument, I said, well, that whiskey didn't sell. It's no good. It's damn good.
So the limited release, the whole idea of it is this opportunity to, it's an accent to the Blade & Bow launch. And so it is stretched out longer than I think that we could have ever hoped it to for a brand. And that is to say, and let everybody know, right? Like it will be gone at some point. There's no more of the liquid that's going into this besides what we have. So like every year there's less and less. But it started, I think, as a way of like being an accent to the launch of the Blade & Bow Kentucky Straight Bourbon, where like this is a symbol of one particular place, right? And that is the Stutzweller Distillery. Blade & Bow 22-year-old is, I think, just a symbol of like the hospitality portion of the story and the bourbon industry. Because a lot of people think that this is the same, that Stutzweller bourbon going into this bottle that goes into the Solera, but we couldn't spare any of that. That all had to be in this guy. So what it is it's basically two historic liquids that have been most recently aging at the Stutzweller Distillery. And so it's one of these opportunities where it's small, you know, small lots between the bourbons that were in the warehouses, both blended together, the younger of the two, which was 22 years old.
What was the older of the two then?
They didn't give me the age statement on the older one.
It was historic.
We'll say 22 and a half. Then.
22 and a half. So the two of them and just those two whiskeys mingle together to create this. And like, it's like that idea of historic sites coming together to create something is, I think, what it represents. And the nose is one of my favorite parts.
It's incredible.
And honestly, pouring it and then letting it sit for a while, like there's an evolution to that nose that kind of, I've used the description before that I kind of consider it's where right out of the bottle, it's like an apple pie after you put it together, but you haven't baked it. And like when you let it sit for about 10 minutes in contact with oxygen, all of a sudden it kind of shifts to that like out of the oven aroma because it just opens up. You've got more of it. The aromatics just kind of punch through, and there's like, I think more like the doughy qualities kind of pop out. So yep. It's one of these things where it's like baking an apple pie just by pouring
the sugar has melted down and mm-hmm. opens up.
Exactly.
Man, it smells like, yeah, gooey caramel Dutch apple pie or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for anybody that doesn't know, so the 22 years also, it's a super limited release, right? I mean, how many bottles of that usually go out? Do you know?
It changes every year, right? So I think that it's...
Because maybe next year it'll be a 23 year? Who knows?
No, well, it changes the... everything, from my understanding, everything is ready to ship when it comes to this whiskey at this point, you know, so that it, like, it, they wanted to arrest the process so that it is consistent from release to release.
So it's tanked right now.
It's tanked.
Yeah.
Tanked or bottled, depending on where we are in the year.
Yeah, releasing, you don't want to lose any more.
You don't want to lose any more of it, right? So, and we release it for September. So we try to release it for Bourbon Heritage Month every year is kind of the track on it. And it's, I don't know what our numbers look like this coming year, but I would venture to guess that it's under 2,000 bottles, you know, and that's me shot in the dark on that one. I think that it will continue to get less and less over time.
Yeah. Well, it's a fantastic expression, fantastic whiskey. I think it's one of these things as a whiskey geek, if you never had a chance to try something, because we've had plenty of stuff that's over 20 years old, and most of the time it doesn't hit the mark. I mean, honestly, it's just usually what can happen. It can get over oaked. It can have this sort of funkiness.
Musty, like old sort of basement character. Kind of thing going.
This is the exact opposite. You get a little bit of the dusty funkiness to it. You get the complexity of the wood. You've got just brown sugar caramel balm.
It's hitting all the check boxes.
Yeah.
I'm in love right now.
Yeah.
I think that's a testament too. When you get to this age range, I feel like it's not a bad idea to look at, you know, like singular lots or, you know, single barrels in this range. Like you're so hit or miss. But the second you try to mingle to accentuate whatever, like, you know, when you focus on one whiskey or one age range, and then you're like, all right, so we want to hold on to the best qualities of this, but how do we accentuate it? That's where mingling them together, I think, really makes it shine.
Yeah, because I know a lot of the distilleries that have an older offering, like 18, 20 years plus, a lot of it they have to just dump into like to their, you know, lowest offering because they're like, it's just too not good,
right?
You know?
Yeah, it's always going to lend something, right? Like, all right, so we'll put it in our younger stuff because it's going to lend structure, but it's not going to hold up on its own when it comes to aromatic.
So from another kind of business aspect of this, when we start thinking about the distilleries that Diageo owns only in Kentucky, which the only one that kind of rings a bell is the largest is going to be the Bulleit Distillery, right? Is there an anticipation that Bulleit will be creating whiskey that'll be going into Blade & Bow one of these days or to any other kind of offerings that would be in that portfolio?
You know, I would venture to guess not anytime soon. One, the identity.
Because Bulleit needs it for their own brand, yeah, probably.
Exactly. Right. I mean, one, the staggering and wonderful sales that Bulleit's had and like the across the country over the past, you know, really, I think 10 years anyway, is just astounding. And I think that they need, even with that new facility, they need all the liquid that's coming off of that still they can get into that. Two, the profile of Bulleit, I think, is something that's pretty far away from what's in this bottle, you know? So I don't know that flavor profile-wise, the whiskey that's coming out of that facility would line up really well. So I think for now, we're looking at what's being made at Stitzelweller, which is a super small amount, and then really relying on partnerships across the country or across the state in order to put this guy together. You know, we do have the new facility in Lebanon, Kentucky, as well as, you know, the Cascade Hollow Distillery. But I think both of them, one, Lebanon's brand new. So I think that they're probably still finding their feet for what's coming off of the still down there. And two, Cascade Hollow's got its hands full already, so which is a great problem to have because I think that
plus you couldn't really have a blend of Kentucky and then Tennessee, and then you got to go to people who sit so well and be like, hey, it's a blend of Kentucky Tennessee, and be like, wait a minute,
we're covering the South, it fits in the story.
Yeah, there you go.
Blend and Bow.
Garden and Gun.
I'm well aware that would not go over too well in the state of Kentucky.
Yeah.
Well, all right,
you get your purists out there, and that's for sure.
So Diageo clearly, you know, is a brand powerhouse, and that's what they do. They build brands. What What is that secret sauce that, you know, gives them, or what do you think that, I mean, you don't have to share all their secrets, but like,
at least one secret.
Yeah. At least one secret.
At least one secret.
Yeah. I think besides this, the wonderful education that they put out in the field, you mean?
That's right. Of course. Besides those brand educators.
Right.
That's the top of the pyramid.
Honestly, I think it's that Diageo is really great at identifying brand, identifying what the identity of the brand is, really case by case. You know, you look at something in their portfolio, and even just with American whiskey, like the identities of the whiskeys that they have are very different. They operate in different spaces, let alone like price points and everything else. So I think it's the fact that they're so focused on building one brand individually from each other that it's not one template. You know, what they use for Johnnie Walker is so different than what they use for Bulleit or, you know, whatever it may be. So I think the key for them building brands is the idea of like really tapping into the identity of each spirit and running from there.
Well, Doug, I want to say thank you again for coming on and sharing a little bit of insight into Blade & Bow. I know it's one of those things that I think everybody that's a whiskey geek has heard about it. They've seen it on the shelves, but they might not know about what goes into it. That, or they have the reservations of like, that's just all marketing of BS of Stutzweiler and blah, blah, blah. But it's good to have somebody that's an authoritative voice to be able to kind of talk about it and rest assured that, yes, there is something going in there, but make sure you buy it now. This is the sales point. Make sure you buy it now before it gets stretched out even further down the line, right?
You know, I have yet to see a shift. There's such consistency in that bottle, but yeah, 100%. I think that I always love having these conversations, and it's great to have. And you know, one of the things that I've always tried to keep in my education is like as much transparency. You can ask the hard questions, and if I can't answer it the way that we want to answer it, I'm just going to tell you anyway. But it is really great to like give people a little more access. I would definitely say too, if people haven't come out to see the Stutzweiler Distillery, you know, it gives a great connection to Blade & Bow, but it's so worth just feeling the history and like understanding how you can get so inspired that you got to do something with a facility like that.
Well, it's such an interesting project. It's not just, hey, let's take the same mash bill, age it in different warehouses, this and that, and brand it 10 different ways. You know, it's like truly unique each time you're doing these Solera blends and whatnot.
It's on a trajectory of such great spaces, I think, in bourbon right now, too, is like these really unique projects that are interesting. And I think, you know, people are open to it more than they were 5 years ago. And I think it's really awesome. So,
yeah, I'm a fan.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that you bring up a good point, too, is that this is an easy introduction for a lot of people that are getting into whiskey as well. At 91 points, I mean, you're looking at something that, and I honestly feel that you get the nose of a younger whiskey, but you get the taste and the oak of an older one. However, you know, you don't get that bold rye spice. You don't get any of that sort of delicate wheat or anything like that. It's a very just kind of middle of the road kind of way to kind of ease people into it. So I think it's
perfectly balanced. It's approachable. It's not like too offensive, not too pronounced one way or the other. It's so easy to drink.
Yeah.
It's like if somebody hadn't drank bourbon before, I'd be like, come over, try this, let's go. It's not, you know, entry level, but it's good balance of,
I'd say it's entry level for, at least with a proof point for some people, but hey, that's just me.
I think it's above that.
I kind of agree with both of you. You know, honestly, it's one of those things where you can find the complexity if you're looking for it, or
if you're
uninitiated, it's not going to bother you. So
you
can
satisfy both crowds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Doug, again, I want to say thank you for coming on the show, giving us some insight into your, not only just your history, but into the history of the brand and stuff like that. But if people want to learn more about Blade & Bow, they want to get in contact with you, they're like, hey, come and teach us about everything about the five keys, how would they do something like that?
So I would say, you know, either going to the Stutzweiler Distillery website, stutzwellerdistillery.com or bladeandbow.com is a great place to do it. As well as if you do collect all five of those keys, that's where you're going to want to go to reach out to get a part of the five key club.
I'm going hunting today. I need two through five now.
Do you have to go and like put them in an envelope and like mail the keys somewhere? Or, like, take a picture of it?
Take a picture and send them to us. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, we may want to double check you, but I think if you take a picture,
you got to bring receipts in.
Yeah. Timestamp that thing. Yeah. Yeah. You can send us a picture. And we'll get your name on a julep cup, which is pretty great. And definitely, you know, I'm there as much as I can, not as much as I would like, but you can always come out to the Stutzweller Distillery out in Shively.
What days is it open?
So we are open Wednesday through Sunday, and Sundays we don't open until 12:30, but it's 10 to 5:30.
And it's food and drink.
Food and drink. So the Garden and Gun Club doesn't open until 11, and that's Thursday through Sunday.
Gotcha.
Right. But we do have tours on Wednesday as well. So kind of reopening those tour gates a little bit more as we can. So
sure.
Yeah. Right on. Well, we're cool. So make sure you go check out Blade and Bow. Make sure you check out everything Diageo is doing as well, because they've got a huge portfolio of whiskeys that they're doing. But make sure you all check out bourbonpursuit.com for any old episodes. Join our mailing list and also follow us on all the socials, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And with that, cheers, everybody. We'll see you next week.